Certainly remote for my folks, but for a little kid, it was great.
Alaska's new top military commander spent part of his childhood in Adak. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, November 28th. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, an Alaskan who's on a quest to design a better way to clean up oil spills.
And I'd be a fool to sit there and say it's because I'm going to save the world. When I first started into this, it was because I knew that there was a better way to do it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Alaska has a new top military commander. Lieutenant General Kenneth Wilsbach started this August, taking over as head of the 11th Air Force, the Alaska NORAD region, and Alaskan Command from Lieutenant General Russell Handy. But this is hardly Wilsbach's first time serving in the last frontier. Inside a nondescript building nestled between airplane hangars at J-Bear, eight fighter pilots in green jumpsuits huddle around a desk. Few eat panfuls of jalapeno popcorn as they listen to a pre-flight briefing.
Temperatures, as listed, starting to get relatively cold, and Stoney said please dress.
These guys are getting ready to fly F-22 fighter jets for a training mission, and among them is Wilsbach, Alaska's highest-ranking officer, with duties sprawling all the way from here to islands in the Pacific. The general rose through the Air Force flying and commanding fighter squadrons, and as we walk out to a jet hangar buffeted by winds and temperatures in the teens, General Wilsbach is as calm as he is focused. Amid the din of roaring jet engines, he compares getting ready for flight to preparing for a sports match. In spite of his high rank, Wilsbach still flies, which he says informs his ability to command other pilots.
You know, I did this even when I was in Afghanistan, and I can't tell you how valuable that was for me to be out in the airspace conducting combat operations when my, you know, fellow generals were back in the headquarters.
When Wilsbach spoke in his office, he showed off commendations and gifts from his deployments around the globe, such as a battle axe from the United Arab Emirates, a framed sketch of the air tower at Bagram Air Base, and a painted helmet from Okinawa, Japan.
You see it's got my call sign, which is Cruiser.
How'd you get Cruiser?
I can't tell you that story.
On one side of the office is a coffee maker emblazoned with a Gators logo for the University of Florida, where Wilsbach and his wife both went and remain self-described rabid fans of the school's sports. In another corner are several different bulky gray telephones used for classified calls around the globe.
We try not to go through secretaries and middle people. These are commanders talking to commander on a classified phone. This is just a regular phone, but you put a card in it, it scrambles and encrypts the signal, and so I can talk secret on that one as well.
Wilsbach was stationed in Alaska from 1998 to 2002 and was in charge of an air squadron when 9/11 happened, which led to his first combat command. But he'd actually lived in Alaska once before. His dad was stationed on Adak in 1969, where Wilsbach would camp and play among remnants of the Pacific Campaign.
It was certainly remote for my folks, but for a little kid, it was great.
Since his earlier posting in Alaska, the Air Force here and abroad has changed a lot. Back then, the force was built to wage World War III and has since shrunk to the smallest it's ever been, primarily from shedding fighter squadrons. Instead, the emphasis is on intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, staples of counterterrorism operations. Alaska, though, in some ways bucks that trend.
We have about the same amount that we had in the 90s here in Alaska. It's been modernized, though.
During his command, Wilsbach will oversee the installation of the newest generation of jet fighters to Alaska's fleet. By 2022, there'll be dozens of F-35s here, doubling the size of Eielson Air Force Base in Fairbanks, bringing hundreds of millions of dollars in new construction. Integrating those new tools smoothly into the military's Northern and Pacific forces is one of this jet pilot's main tasks for the years ahead. Cleaning up after a major oil spill is a huge challenge. After the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster, the federal government estimates responders removed only about a quarter of the nearly 5 billion barrels of oil released. One Alaskan thinks he's figured out a better way to do it. He doesn't work in a lab, he doesn't have any fancy degrees, but some experts think he may be onto something. Alaska's Energy Desk's Elizabeth Harbaugh reports.
See, that must look like a net.
Kevin Kennedy is poking around what he refers to as his mad scientist den.
Here's my very, very original model, just to test it.
It's a garage that smells strongly of oil, cluttered with mechanical parts and tools, right behind Kennedy's house in South Anchorage. Here, Kennedy's poured his soul, and he says his retirement, into developing a new kind of oil spill cleanup technology. Kennedy knows just how damaging an oil spill can be. On Good Friday in 1989, he was getting his shrimp boat ready for a day of work in Prince William Sound.
You know, I didn't have any idea how big it was until I got 3.5-4 hours out of Whittier and got to Night Island Pass, and then you could smell it. Yeah, and then you could start seeing it, and it just kept coming and coming and coming.
The day the Exxon Valdez ran aground was Kennedy's last day as a shrimper. He helped with the cleanup effort instead. Since then, Kennedy has gone from occasional tinkering to all-consuming work to develop a better way to clean up oil spills. On his website, Kennedy's posted videos of his inventions at work. This is the sound of him testing one he calls the Otter Skimmer on a spill off Louisiana's coast. A net extends into the ocean, corralling the oil towards a little red pontoon boat. There, a device separates the oil from the water and pumps it into a storage container. Kennedy claims it works a lot better than the equipment response teams use to clean up oil spills today.
You know, nobody makes anything that works in Alaska until it hits the beach.
But for a self-taught, self-funded inventor like Kennedy, trying to break into the market has been a long, hard journey. Over the years, Matt Melton has heard Kennedy's pitch a lot. Melton is general manager of an oil spill response team based in Anchorage called the Alaska Chideau Corporation.
In the last 10 years that I've been in this business, Kevin's been there too. He's kind of he's just always there. It's quite amazing. He's a unique man.
Melton says Kennedy's an unconventional figure in the oil spill response world, but he also thinks he may be onto something. He says Kennedy's device is efficient at separating oil from water, which makes it easier to store the waste during a cleanup. Alaska Chideau Corporation can't endorse his equipment, but on certain uniquely challenging spills, Melton says he thinks Kennedy's device might come in handy.
If I had an oil spill tomorrow and I called Kevin and he had one sitting on his shelf, I'd take it in a second.
But oil spill response teams like Melton still aren't rushing to buy Kennedy's technology. Most already have cleanup equipment on hand that meets all their requirements, and they're used to using that equipment. And some experts disagree with Kennedy's assertion that the equipment hasn't improved at all since the Exxon Valdez.
The bread and butter, the basic equipment, hasn't changed a whole lot. Like, you still use the same type of equipment, but there have been certain improvements to some of the equipment.
That's Richard Bernhardt, who works on oil spill response with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. Bernhardt says skimmers have gotten a lot more efficient since Exxon Valdez. Barclay Lloyd agrees. He's the president and general manager of Alaska Clean Seas, an oil spill response group on the North Slope. But Lloyd says that doesn't mean there isn't room for improvement.
You always want more. It's always great to have the solution to everything.
Kennedy says he isn't promising a solution to everything, but he thinks his spill technology is an important step in that direction.
And I'd be a fool to sit there and say it's because I'm going to save the world. When I first started into this, it was because I knew that there was a better way to do it.
Kennedy is determined to keep pushing forward until response teams actually start using his invention to clean up oil spills. Then he says he doesn't want to invent another thing again. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
The trial of an Anchorage couple charged with igniting the devastating Sockeye Fire in the summer of 2015 is scheduled to start Tuesday in district court in Palmer. The fire destroyed 55 Willow area homes and cost $8 million to fight. State prosecutors say defendants Greg Immig, age 60, and Amy DeWitt, 42, burned debris in June of 2015 without properly clearing the area or keeping water on hand. Fire escaped into the forest where hot, dry conditions and high winds fueled the blaze. Efforts by state attorneys to negotiate a settlement stalled in midsummer of this year. The state has charged Imig and DeWitt with 8 misdemeanor counts, ranging from reckless endangerment to failure to obtain a burn permit. The state expects to call scores of witnesses, such as firefighters, homeowners, state troopers, and fire investigators. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Kanaitse tribe hosts a moose hunting trip for young men.
I'm the oldest of 8, and all of my brothers and sisters are coming up through this program, so it's kind of something for me to watch them grow.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
It was a historic year for the Chilkat Indian village of Kluquan. After more than a decade of work, the Chilkat Kwan Cultural Heritage Center opened its doors in May. The center tells the evolving story of the Chilkat people. It also houses some of the world's most admired works of North Coast art, the Whale House Collection. KHNS's Emily Files has the story.
We just stepped into the exhibit gallery, and the first thing that you see when you walk into our exhibit gallery is the Chilkat Cultural Landscape Map.
Lonnie Hotch is the executive director of the Chilkat Kwan Heritage Center.
Chilkat Kwan Ani, the land of the Chilkat people. And there's a quote there, Anyat Kusani. And it's a formal way to address a crowd of people.
It means honorable people of the land.
And I thought that was so appropriate because whether you live in a little house along the Chilkat River or a skyscraper in Manhattan, we're all dependent on the land.
Hotch is one of the Kluquan residents who led the enormous effort to build this cultural center. Kluquan is a village of about 100 people, and the cost of the center is close to $8 million. The idea for a cultural center has been around for almost a century, but the effort that finally led to success began with a strategic planning session about 15 years ago.
Then we went through this visioning process of what we wanted Kluquan to look like in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. And this was a huge part of that vision.
Hotch says they talked about Kluquan's strongest assets, a rich cultural heritage and a beautiful landscape.
The idea behind this building is not so much museum, but a culture center where our people can still carry their culture forward.
The centerpiece of the cultural center is a collection of masterful artworks that are between 200 and 300 years old. The famed Whale House rain screen and house posts are arranged to create a functioning clan house within the center.
I don't think anyone could ever duplicate what we're looking at.
Jones Hotch Jr. is Lonnie Hotch's husband. He's also the Gaanak Teti clan leader and caretaker of the Whale House.
The 4 house posts and the rain screen, what I say is, what I've told other people is, that's our birth certificate, tells us where we're from.
During the planning of the cultural center, the Gaanak Teti clan agreed to house the objects here, even though putting them in a public place is a break from tradition. One reason to keep them here is for protection. Over the last century or so, there have been multiple attempts to remove the Whale House artifacts and display them outside of Kluquan.
So many of our Atu are objects. They're on different museums. They're not home. This is what we're standing on. This is their homeland.
Hotch remembers the day the Whale House objects were returned to Kluquan. It was raining.
I said, it's the elders are crying. They're happy they're back, getting back to Kluquan.
I think the most gratifying thing is seeing the young people taking hold of it.
Again, Lonnie Hotch. Her hope is that the cultural center will bring back young people who haven't been able to find employment in Klukwan before.
But this is their future. And that's why we did it, you know.
Hotch says she can already see that happening. The center employed about 25 people over the summer. In a village of about 100, it's a big impact. And that, Hotch says, makes the enormous effort it took to bring the center to life worth it. Reporting in Klukwan, I'm Emily Files.
For wildlife biologists, understanding the basics about an animal species is key. When it comes to marine mammals, collecting even the most basic information can be a challenge. But researchers at the Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward have developed a new way to track harbor seals. KBBI's Shayla Farzan has more.
Marcus Horning spends a lot of time thinking about harbor seals. As the science director at the Alaska Sea Life Center, he's spent years trying to understand these animals. Turns out, there's a lot we don't know about seals.
We need data on survival, on reproduction, on the age at which female seals first breed, and then how many offspring they have throughout their lives.
Because harbor seals spend so much time underwater and live in remote locations, Horning realized he would need to develop a special way to study them. So he created a tag, but not just any kind of tag. It's a lightweight, pill-shaped device about the size of a sea battery, and it's filled with sensors, temperature, motion, and light. Horning surgically implants these tags into seals. Despite its small size, the tag collects mountains of data. It has a little transmitter, so it can send all of the data back to a satellite. But here's the kicker. The tag can't talk to the satellite when it's inside the animal.
To be able to reach a satellite at an elevation of 400 miles up in the sky, we need a very strong signal. And inside of the body, the signal is so weakened that we could never reach a satellite. So while the tag is inside of the body, while the animal's alive, we can never hear from the tag. We don't get any data right now.
The lightweight tag is filled with microscopic, hollow glass balls to help it float. Once an animal dies, the tag eventually floats up to the water surface and transmits its information to a satellite.
I would describe it as an electronic black box that is like a black box in an airplane. It stores information about the state of the airplane, and in this case, the state of a seal. But it doesn't really transmit that until after something bad happens. And in this case, it doesn't really transmit until after an animal has died.
All those years of information the tags collect can be a real goldmine for researchers like Horning. Not only can the tags tell how long an animal lived, they can also give us a good idea how it died.
When we have a very abrupt temperature drop to ambient temperatures, and when we have an immediate sensing of light and also air, that's when we assume the tag came out of the animal. And really, the only way this could have happened is if the animal was dismembered by a predator.
So far, Horning's lab has implanted tags in 10 harbor seals, and they're feeling hopeful. Based on tests with Stellar sea lions, they have a 98% chance of receiving data once an animal dies. They're just not sure how long it's going to take. In Homer, I'm Shayla Farzan.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. It's a fact. 85% of Alaska Native and American Indian people don't use illegal drugs. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/weare. This message sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization.
Iditarod mushers will no longer be able to carry dogs in trailers behind their sleds. Aaron Burmeister is treasurer for the Iditarod's board of directors and says the change came during a meeting at the end of last month.
Mainly, it clarifies that dogs will be hauled in the front sled if they're being hauled during the race. It's clarifying we're not hauling dogs in trailers for safety reasons.
Though used by a minority of Iditarod mushers, trailers fixed behind the primary sled have grown in popularity as a way to cycle dogs through rest, particularly among the sport's top performers. Some mushers have been critical of the new rule, along with another controversial change passed by the board that allows for two-way communication devices like cell phones to be carried on the trail. The new rules will be in effect for the upcoming Iditarod in March. The University of Alaska Anchorage men's basketball team claimed 7th place in the Great Alaska Shootout, beating NCAA Division I opponent Drake University. APRN's Josh Edge has more.
UAA head coach Rusty Osborne said during the Seawolves' 74-69 win, the team was focusing on three things.
Play hard every possession, have fun, and be the toughest team. And for the first 2 days, I thought we did all those. And we started the game like that, and then we stopped playing hard every possession. We stopped respecting our opponent, and that's unacceptable. And to their credit, they came out in the second half and they turned it around, which is sometimes hard to do when you get into a mindset like that.
UAA was led in scoring against Drake by senior guard Suki Wiggs' 24-point outing. He rebounded after struggling in the Seawolves' first two shootout games when he sank only 5 of 37 shot attempts from the floor.
Both those teams played wonderful defense on me. They had something on me at all times, but just my teammates and Oz here and my coaches having faith in me through the end is what got me through. So just got to bounce back when things happen like that, and that's what I did tonight.
Against Drake, Wiggs hit 7 of 17 shots, with 11 of those attempts coming from beyond the three-point arc. He also shot 70% from the free throw line. Osborne said he was impressed with the efforts of players coming off the bench.
Especially late, coming in and holding off their charge. Made a few little mistakes, but we had some guys in there that don't play a lot.
Three Seawolves played more than 30 minutes on Saturday. And behind Wiggs' 24 points, senior guard Spencer Svekar and Deontay Mitchell netted 20 and 11 points, respectively. Iona College claimed the men's shootout title with a 75-73 win over Nevada. UAA begins regular season play Thursday against Division II Great Northwest Athletic Conference opponent Central Washington. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
The Kenaitse Indian tribe in Kenai is taking an innovative approach to drug, alcohol, and tobacco prevention. In addition to education, the tribe offers culturally relevant activities through their Yanganan Youth Center, located in Soldotna, including a moose camp in the fall for young men. KBBI's Daisha Eaton has more.
Eugen Ivanov carefully strips the outside layer off a large burgundy leg of moose.
This meat was hung. It develops a crust on it. So right now we are stripping it off so we can butcher this meat and get it to our elders.
Ivanov is Dena Ina from Nondalton near Lake Clark. People on the Central Peninsula say Denaina. He grew up in Soldotna and now works as a youth advocate for the Kenaitse Indian Tribe's Yaganan Youth Center in Soldotna. This past weekend, a group of young men went hunting on the Kenai through the center, and they were successful. Ivanov shows 15-year-old Wally James how to peel a piece of white tendon off the meat.
Get your knife right between.
James is a freshman at Kenai Central High School, Yupik, and originally from Russian Mission. He moved to Kenai last year. He's been moose hunting before.
It reminds me of when I go hunting in my hometown with my sister and family.
Standing in the large warehouse-like building surrounded by 7 young men butchering meat at 4 tables, Yaganan Youth Center Administrator Michael Leonard says it's not just about putting food in the freezer.
The concept is that we are providing a safe, positive atmosphere where young people can come and learn that it's okay to be substance-free.
Yaganan is a prevention and early intervention organization that provides a safe environment for youth. The harvest and processing of the moose, Leonard says, is also a way to convey critical traditional values to young men.
The activities that we do have a cultural relevance to them. We are touching on several, if not many, of the cultural values, you know, the hard work, sharing, teamwork, and providing for our elders.
Moose is a traditional food for Kenaitse Indians. The camp is free and open to all young men in the community, native and non-native alike. The young men receive training on gun safety, knife handling, butchering, and food handling. They also learn how to build survival shelters and about the natural history of moose. Bernard says they try to schedule the camps during vacations and are working with the Kenai Peninsula School District to allow students to earn elective credits for attending the camps. Gideon Culver is a junior at Soldotna High School. The 16-year-old is not Alaska Native and says he had never gone moose hunting before. He says the best part was being in the woods and learning about respect for the animal.
Kind of an inward respect, treating it with respect. We were all fairly silent when we first got it, and looking at it, seeing that it had given its life so that we could have food, and it kind of gave me more respect for the Naina and how they, you know, their survival depended on something else's death.
Kenaitse tribal member Sandy K. Wilson is a youth advocate at the Yaganan Center. She says the camp is also about building pride and confidence.
Teaching our culture is, you know, it makes them proud of who they are and teaches them where they come from. And so when we teach our culture, it gives them a sense of pride.
Wilson is also the mother of several children involved in programs at the youth center. Her oldest son, 23-year-old Jonathan Wilson, started attending activities at the youth center when he was in sixth grade. Now he's a mentor in the program.
I'm the oldest of eight, and all of my brothers and sisters are coming up through this program, so it's kind of something for me to watch them grow.
In Kenai, at the tribe's senior center, the young men deliver the meat to elders. Kathleen Zakar, originally from Sleetmute, has lived in Kenai for several years. She says she doesn't have any moose meat in the freezer this year, and she's happy to have some freshly delivered from the young men.
I got me a kidney.
A delicacy that Zakar says she will eat fried.
And it's great that they teach them how to do that. That's our culture. And if we don't have our culture anymore, what do we have? We don't got nothing.
Next time, Zakar says, she's putting in a request for moose ribs, her favorite. In Kenai, I'm Daisha Eaton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Elizabeth Harbaugh, Ellen Lockyer, and Josh Edge in Anchorage, Daisha Eaton and Shayla Farzan in Homer, and Emily Files in Haynes. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. Annie Fite edited tonight's show, and I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, supporting Alaska's workforce and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
And by
GCI, keeping Alaskans connected to live the life they choose. GCI is an Alaska-born and raised telecommunications company and a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every day. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.